Hello and welcome to QSO. It's all about ham radio. Don't touch that dial. This week, here is the interview you've been waiting for. K1 RFD, Jonathan Taylor, the creator of Echolink. We've been waiting to get with this fellow for a long time, and now we got him. And you're going to hear all about Echolink and his beginnings in ham radio. It's a fascinating story. It's an incredible story. What a piece of technology, Echolink. It's all coming up right here on QSO. It operates 20 through 10 meters. It's stealth. It will keep up with any three-element beam and any vertical that you have on your property. But if you can't have a three-element beam or a vertical on your property, you can still have a TW2010. It is stealth. It disappears. We tried to take pictures of it, and we had to move the thing around because it hides so well. There is no compromise in performance with this antenna, and it's portable. You can take it with you on vacation. It's quite unique. They make several flavors of this antenna, however. If you want to operate 80, 40, 60, 30-meter band, it's all there. Go to their website and check it out, transworldantennas.com. That's transworldantennas.com, and check out the special pricing right here now. Here at QSO, we've got something new, and that's a prize closet. And we are in the process of filling that prize closet up. And we're going to be telling you on the air some of the items that we've got in the prize closet. If you'd like to win some of these things, we'd love to see you do that. But what you've got to do is send us an email. Go up to the website, tedrandall.com or qsoradioshow.com. And when you go to that website, just simply send us an email. Say hello, tell us where you're listening, how the signal's coming in. If you're listening by podcast, tell us how you have joined this radio show. And then put a little note in there that says, I want to win. And we'll put your name in the hat, and we will have a drawing twice a month, and we're going to be giving away what's in our prize closet. Now, I can't tell you everything that's in there so far, but we'll be posting those items up on the website, and we'll be telling you about them on the air. But don't miss out. Send us an email and put in that email, I want to win. And let's see who the lucky winners will be. Our guest is Jonathan Taylor, K1 RFD. And Jonathan is the brains and the creativity behind Echolink. Welcome aboard. How are you doing today?
I'm good, Ted. How are you doing?
I'm doing fine. Well, you know, I'm going to tell you, I didn't know that at any particular point in time I would ever meet you or talk to you. I didn't have any idea who you even were. But when I stumbled on Echolink, it absolutely blew my mind, because I was in ham. I've been in ham radio since I was very young. And I took a look at this thing, and I thought, my God, how remarkable is this? And, of course, I know there's the other system, IRLP, which is great. And I think it's really cool when you're driving around in the car. But to think that on a notebook in the most obscure place in the middle of a cornfield, with a Verizon card, I can log into a repeater overseas and talk to somebody driving in their car is just absolutely unheard of. So tell me a little bit about the background on Echolink. Where did the idea come from, and how did you get started with this thing?
Well, it's interesting, Ted, that you mentioned IRLP. I also worked on another software package, which is still kicking around, called EchoStation, which can be used as a repeater controller. It's another PC program. And I got an email from somebody shortly after I released that program that said something to the effect of, this is great, but is there a way to hook it into a VoIP network such as IRLP? And I thought, that's a pretty good idea, because potentially you could use the Internet to link pieces of a repeater together, like the satellite receivers or an external transmitter or something. So I looked into it, And it didn't turn out that connecting it with IRLP was really practical because IRLP was totally Linux-based. But I started looking around a little bit, and then I was intrigued by another program that had come out called iLink. And this was back in, I guess, around 2001. And iLink was a program that was designed to run on the desktop on a PC that could be used to link to repeaters that had been equipped in the same way. And this was really the first time that somebody had successfully released a program that lets you do, you know, ham radio linking from your desktop on a PC. And I sort of put two things together, and I realized that there was a lot of room for improvement in that program and a lot of other potential for voice over IP applications for ham radio. And I just sat down and crafted something that was a little bit different, but worked in some of the same protocols as iLink, and just put it out there thinking that maybe a couple people might download it. And it just kind of grew like crazy after that. It was really actually, for a while, it was more than I could handle. But I'm pleased to see that it's been successful since then. And that was about 7 years ago.
Well, I recall seeing the program, and I don't know where it was in terms of its stages of development, but I had downloaded the program, and it was one of the very first things that I tried that actually worked for me. And I try a lot of things that don't work for me. You know, they work for other people, but not for me. And I downloaded it, put it on a desktop, and I was really quite surprised. And it was in the studio, so I had, you know, a radio console, and I think at that time I had an Electro Voice RE20 microphone hooked up to the console because I was using it for radio and radio production, you know, and listening over a pair of AKG headphones, and I thought, wow, how cool is this? And made quite a few QSOs with it. And I think one of the most interesting things that's happened to me personally with Echolink is my son, Matt, is in a van driving to Florida to help some fellas that are on kind of a missionary project down there. And he had the notebook in his car, and he logged into a repeater somewhere over in Europe and started to talk to some guy who was driving along the local path there. And these guys in the van are all listening to this, you know, and they're just mesmerized by it. And of course, when it comes to demonstrating ham radio today, there's nothing better than that to show a bunch of young people to get their attention. You know, I mean, that definitely gets their attention. So after he got done with that QSO, he called me on the phone and he said, "Why don't you log into, I forget what machine it was, somewhere." So I got on my notebook and I logged into a local repeater in the area that he was in through Echolink, and then worked him on his HT. So they saw both ends of it happen, and they were quite amazed. They really were. What a demonstration, you know. What a way to demonstrate ham radio. Well, how many people right now, or how many licensed hams are actually, I don't know if you would say join? Are they members, or you consider them a member when they join, or are they registered, or how do you consider it?
Yeah, we call them registered users. Well, there are about 175,000 worldwide right now, and that's in, I believe, 142 countries. So the world is pretty well represented. And it's interesting that there was sort of a milestone about maybe 18 months, 2 years ago, where it used to be that well over half of the users were from the United States or Canada. And that actually has changed now, so that it's only about 48%, which means that the majority of the users right now are outside of North America. And in fact, the highest growth recently has been in the Far East, especially in China. So it's kind of interesting using the statistics that we see from our registration database to reflect, I don't know if it's the worldwide interest in amateur radio or just perhaps, you know, the rollout of broadband internet services, but it's kind of interesting to see how that works. The registration is actually fairly secure now. It has changed over the years, but we now require both proof of identity and proof of license for anybody who signs up for the system. So that number includes everybody who has given us proof that they are a ham radio operator and that they're using the call sign that they've been assigned.
Well, you know, I guess the thing is, I probably shouldn't bring this up, but I will. The onus of this whole situation, if an unlicensed person somehow happened onto the system, is still the responsibility of the repeater operator or the person controlling the repeater. And so I guess it behooves everybody in the system to watch and look and make sure that that everything is cool. What happens, though? Let's just say, for example, some ham, a non-ham, happens onto the system by means of, let's say, that they get on somebody's, they steal a notebook from someone and they get on. And you hear this. Who would you report this to? How would you, I mean, I thought about this a couple times. How in the world would you get the word out to somebody? How do you shut them down, so to speak?
Well, we have a web page that you can use to report a problem or ask a question. We call it opening a ticket. It's like a support ticket. And that gets routed to a small group of volunteers who work with me on this. And anytime there's a problem that would come up like that, one of the first things we can do is just basically take that call sign out of the system, which happens immediately. Fortunately, that comes up very rarely, but if it does, since we have a sort of a central point of control, we can remove any call sign from the system that's been registered, and we can take some other steps as well. But fortunately, that doesn't happen too often.
Well, I was going to say, I know I've heard some guys bring it up and say, well, what do you do about this? And I say, well, it's pretty secure, because I know when I've tried to log in several times or I forgot my login or something, it wasn't a real simple, easy process that somebody could just hack to get into the system, And that has been, I've had people ask me that. I thought, well, I don't know. I don't know the whereabouts on that thing. But I've never heard anything on EchoLink that was out of the way. Everything I've always heard have been people talking on a local repeater. The only complaint I've got is I just wish there was more activity on EchoLink.
Well, it's interesting that you mentioned that, because there is a great deal of activity, but the problem is there's also a very large number of stations logged in now. So the paradox is that as the system has grown, the perception is that there's less activity, but in fact it's as much activity or even more, but it's spread out across a much larger number of nodes.
Well, I guess my assessment of it is not, I'm not assessing EchoLink, I'm assessing VHF and 2 meters and UHF for the most part, because as I drive across the United States, and we've commented on this, and I've had a number of guests on this talked about it too, you can go to a local repeater in some town somewhere and throw out your call sign and never hear a soul. And then go into another town and throw out your call sign and never hear a soul. So it is not a problem with EchoLink. It is a problem with UHF, VHF, period. And I just, like I said, I just wish there was more activity, because I've been places where I've had a few hours to kill, and I've opened the notebook up. And I'll be honest with you, I go to my hometown of Detroit and log into a machine somewhere and give out my call sign and then sit there and sip coffee and not hear a soul. EchoLink's perking right along, working great, but there just isn't anybody there. And go ahead.
That is a problem with, as you mentioned, sort of with VHF repeaters in general. It seems to kind of come in waves, I think, in each local area. And it's nothing like it was, I guess, during sort of the peak in the late 1970s. There actually is a feature that I've been working on in EchoLink, which is hopefully going to address that problem, which you could sort of loosely call a CQ feature. The idea is that the way it works is that the server will try to match people up who are both interested in calling CQ and then find them and connect them to each other. The idea is that whether you're sitting in front of a computer screen or actually mobiling somewhere, you can send a command to EchoLink that basically says, look, I'm here, I'm looking for somebody to talk to, can you find somebody who has the same request and can sort of connect us together? And there obviously are some preferences there, especially with respect to language. But I think this will be a big improvement once we roll it out to helping to find a QSO if you're in some place you're not familiar with.
Well, let me ask you a question. And I think that would be a milestone, because I've often thought when I've got on EchoLink, the thought has crossed my mind that there's somewhere, there's somebody just like me looking around, you know, and trying to find a conversation. But, you know, the other thing is what about an operation of Echolink? Now, one of the things that I found that keeps a lot of guys off of Echolink, believe it or not, is their fear of not knowing what to do and thinking they're going to do something wrong. And the ones I've talked to, I've told them, I said, I don't think there's anything that you can do on your end to mess up the system. I mean, it's talk and receive, you know, that's it, you know. And if you have a problem, just simply, you know, turn your computer off. If something's not working right, shut the machine off. You're going to be offline then. You're listening to QSO, and we'll be back with more of QSO, as well as Jonathan Taylor, the creator of Echolink, K1RFD, right after this. Week after week, you hear us talk about Transworld antennas, and you hear us talk about the TW2010, the 4040, the Backpacker, and all these different antennas. Of course, the TW2010 Adventurer came first. Folks were amazed at its performance. Then they introduced the Backpacker, and now the 4040. Go to EHAM and read the reviews on the TW2010. Just go to EHAM and read those reviews. Now, you can do that by going to transworldantennas.com. Just go to transworldantennas.com. Transworld Antennas, one word. Go to transworldantennas.com. There's a link on that page that'll take you right straight to the EHAM reviews. Or you can just go to EHAM yourself. And if you're a ham, you know how to get to EHAM on the internet. Just Google it. You'll get there. And read the reviews. See what other amateur radio operators are saying about this antenna. Thank you.
If you're the decision maker for any form of outdoor lighting, you're going to want to listen to this. The Light Pack Systems induction lights, manufactured in the USA by a severely disabled workforce, uses a unique physical principle of light generation. This lamp system is therefore classified in a new family of sources, the Light Pack Induction Lamp Systems. Light Pack induction lighting is a breakthrough for professional, general, and special lighting applications. Not only because of its high luminescence and efficiency, but especially because of its unprecedented lifetime. System lifetime is rated at 100,000 hours, or about 20 years, based on 5,000 burning hours per year, with a failure rate of less than 10%. With this unmatched durability, LightPack offers substantial savings in direct maintenance costs as well as indirect costs. Induction lighting is relatively new in the United States, but it's proven technology developed in Europe over 20 years ago. Therefore, claims of durability is based on real-world empirical data as opposed to estimated design life provided by competitive lighting technologies such as LED. LightPack Systems was founded on the principles of green solutions for modern lighting through strong partnerships with the U.S. military, the University of Central Florida, and several national energy service companies. LightPack offers lighting solutions that provide a better quality of light with a 66% energy savings, also lasting up to 5 times longer than standard lighting options. LightPack's quality shines through with their standard 10-year warranty on all products. Call today for your free demonstration. Go to their website, lightpacksystems.com. That's lightpacksystems.com, spelled LitePackSystems, lightpacksystems.com.
H1N1, if you haven't given it much thought, you need to start now. Go to h1n1kits.us. That's h1n1kits.us. Look at the menu and go to H1N1 Flu Tracker Map USA. You can see exactly where the H1N1 virus is breaking out. It may be in your community already. You can order the Flu Blocker Influenza Kits today. They contain all the necessary personal protection equipment to help guard against the spread of the influenza virus within your work, home, and school environment. These kits contain fever strips, a protective N95 mask, disinfectant surface wipe, antimicrobial hand wipes, and a tissue pack. The H1N1 virus is here, so don't delay. Order your kits today at h1n1kits.us. That's h1n1kits.us. At QSO, we've got a new prize closet, and we've got some interesting things going into that prize closet. be sure and write us and send us that email that says, I want to win. Put that in the text somewhere in that email and go to our website, QSOradioshow.com. That's QSOradioshow.com, and send us an email. Tell us a little bit about yourself, where you're listening, how the signal's coming in, or if you're listening by podcast. But be sure and put on that email, I want to win, because we're going to have some really, really neat things to give away. We'll be putting those things up on the website and telling you more about them on the air. Be sure and don't miss out. Send us an email and put in there, I want to win. Go to QSOradioshow.com. That's QSOradioshow.com or TedRandall.com, R-A-N-D-A-L-L, and we'll look for your email. And now, ladies and gentlemen, back to our guest on QSO, Jonathan Taylor, K1RFD, the creator of Echolink. The question I have is in terms of protocol. A person gets their computer fired up and they say, okay, you know, let's say the guy's from Atlanta, Georgia, and he says, I want to, you know, get on the Atlanta repeater. Now, is it considered to be a bad thing for a person to log into the Atlanta repeater and listen to people talking or their QSOs going on there without necessarily breaking in or disturbing the conversation?
Well, it's a good question. Sort of the operational etiquette when you have this different paradigm from the usual ham radio QSO. I think it's fine, in my opinion, for somebody to do a repeater and just sit there and listen for a while. Some people complain about the situation where somebody connects to a repeater, doesn't hear any activity for, you know, 15 or 20 seconds, and then disconnects. And the problem is that by default, there is an announcement made on the repeater at the other end that says this person is connected, and a similar announcement that indicates when they've disconnected. So I think there is sort of a misconception that it is impolite to do that. But the problem is, or the solution is, that if the operator of the repeater dislikes the announcements that come on that says so-and-so has connected, it's very easy to disable that. In fact, I had considered disabling that by default in future releases of the program. But I think it's fine to connect and listen for a while. I would urge somebody to listen a little bit longer than 15 or 20 seconds, though, because you're much more likely to find some activity if you listen for a few minutes. But there are provisions in the program that prevent it from breaking into a QSO and stepping on somebody at the moment you connect. But it's always a good idea to listen first.
Well, you know, I guess the thing of it is in my habit, in terms of amateur radio is concerned, and I think there's a lot of fellas that are this way, you feel a lot more comfortable, let's say, for example, with a machine that you're not familiar with, and that maybe listen to it for a few days and hear who the people are that are on and see if there's regulars there and all that kind of stuff, and kind of study the lay of the land before you jump in and start making conversation with people. And I do that all the time on HF frequencies. I seldom just jump in. Now, I know that's the old spirit of ham radio, you know. Jump in and talk to a total stranger, get on and call CQ. Today, if you jump in and call CQ on a VHF machine in most cities, you'll get somebody upset. I've done it a couple times just out of plain stupidity. You know, I've been in ham radio since I was a kid, and to me, CQ goes anywhere, okay? That's how I feel about it. But I've had guys get on and say, well, we don't do that on VHF here. We don't call CQ. And I'm like, well, okay, then I won't do that. Thank you very much. But the thing of it is you tend to want to listen before you talk. And I guess the thing of it is I was wondering, though, on Echolink, is that considered, you know, impolite to do that, or is that considered eavesdropping? But I can understand if this machine is going to make an announcement and says so-and-so has just logged in, then on that end, I guess they're expecting somebody to say something at that point, you know, or at least, give out the call sign. But according to what you're saying, the call sign has already been announced on their machine.
Yeah, that's correct. If the machine is set up in the typical way, it is already announced. So it is fine to get on and just listen for a while. And I think that's very good advice, is to sort of get used to how the repeater works. You don't really know. Unless you've connected to that repeater before, you don't really know you know, who's on it, what its activity level is. You might not even know exactly where it's located, you know, how it identifies and that kind of thing. So I think it's a great idea to listen for at least a few minutes and then jump in. I think that's good advice. But it is also fine to drop in your call, and it's just would be the same, basically the same procedure as you would use if you are on RF in the local area. You just say, this is W1XYZ listening. And that's probably the best way to do it. I, by the way, I agree with you. I've never understood the taboo against mentioning the word CQ on a VHF machine. As long as you don't say it over and over again, it gets, it's exactly the same concept as saying this is so-and-so listening. But for some reason, that that irks people who are listening to the repeater.
I don't understand that, but, you know, once again, you know, on HF, I understand the repeated CQs because you have selective fading and atmospheric changes and atmospheric noise and whatnot. That's why you also repeat your call sign a number of times, you know. So on HF, I understand it. On VHF, I can understand that you can call CQ. And once you say CQ, you don't need to repeat it 16 times, you know, unless you really are trying to irritate somebody. But, you know, if you don't hear an answer and you wait another 5 minutes and throw out another CQ, I don't get it. To me, that's the way it ought to be. Because folks are not sitting on the edge of their chair sometimes listening to a machine. If they're working in a room or they're doing something, and I don't know how many times I have heard on VHF a guy come in and say, this is so-and-so, his call sign, and no one responds to him. And I'm continuing to work heavily on what I'm doing. And I hear him call again, you know, and I'm still working along. And when he calls the third time, I stop what I'm doing and I go over the radio, pick up the mic and start talking to him. You know, hey, it's time for a break. This poor guy has been wanting a cue, so I'm going to give him one, you know. And so, I, you know, the little persistence, I don't see anything wrong with that at all. I think that's a good, healthy thing. At least it gives me a break, get away from my radio production stuff. But now with Echolink, what about, for example, now the conversations that take place that are non-RF? Now, I see, and there's a lot I don't understand, so if I ask a stupid question, don't be afraid to call me stupid. I notice that there's a whole list of people on Echolink, and it's listed by station rather than by repeater or a linked radio. And if you wanted to contact another ham, for folks that have not done that, how does that work?
Well, you have a couple of options. If you're sitting in front of your PC, of course, you've got a list of call signs in front of you of other, we call them nodes, that are logged into the system. And as you say, that's a combination of other PC users, which you can tell from the suffix. They have no suffix in their call sign. And RF links, which have either a dash L if they're a simplex link, or a dash R if they're a link to a repeater. If you're looking for a specific person to contact, and that person actually is logged into Echolink from a PC, that person's call sign will appear in the list, and you can just double-click on it and have a PC-to-PC connection. The other way to locate somebody is if you think they are in range of a repeater that you know about that's on the system, in which case you would just double-click on the repeater call sign and then put out a call for them. The procedure is almost the same, except, of course, the person at the other end is on RF, so they need to be called directly. What will happen, of course, on the remote repeater is that it will normally announce your call sign, so even before you have a chance to call your buddy, he may end up calling you, which is fine also. We have talked over the years about integration with APRS and having a way for a mobile user to basically put himself on an APRS map saying, I am so-and-so and I am approximately here, and then integrating that in Echolink in such a way that you can try to contact somebody without knowing what repeater they're listening to by putting sort of those two pieces of data together, saying that since he reported to be in this Latin lawn, he's probably in range of such and such a repeater and it can be reached there. I've talked a little bit with Bob Berninga, the APRS guy, about this, and someday we may integrate that. but it would be sort of a follow me function like the old cell phones used to use.
Well, when you're talking, and I guess my question pertained to PC to PC, which is something that is, I kind of see that as a different facet of Echolink. And what I mean by that is it's unique in that it's using internet and they're hams that are able to talk one to another. Then when we were out in Las Vegas at the National Association of Broadcasters, I ran across their group out there. And the gentleman mentioned to me, he said, it almost as if there's a group operating, and I don't know that they're operating on a repeater. Now, is it possible to operate with a group? Can you get a group of guys talking together on Echolink, and there's no RF involved at all?
Yeah, that's certainly possible. There are what we call conference servers on Echolink, which can accept any number of connections instead of just one-to-one. In fact, any Echolink node can be operated as a conference, so it's not strictly a one-to-one connection. You can have a virtual roundtable where multiple nodes are connected to each other and they can all hear each other's transmissions. But the important thing is that each one of those conferences can be a mixture of PC users and RF users, so that both types of nodes can participate in a conference. Now, it's certainly possible for a conference to consist entirely of, you know, at any given moment, entirely of PC users. One thing I've emphasized is that that's not really what Echolink is designed for. It does support it, but there are other PC-based audio sort of chat programs which operate on the internet, which work a lot better, quite frankly, for that purpose than Echolink does. Echolink is designed to be used with RF links. It does support PC-to-PC communication, but that's not its primary purpose. And I actually keep statistics on how many different types of nodes are talking to each other and how many QSOs are in progress. And I'm pleased to see that really only about maybe 10 or 15% of the QSOs do not use RF links. 85% of them do. So I see that hams are primarily using it as a hybrid between the RF and internet technologies.
I see. The only reason I ask about that is I've wondered special events and special conditions where hams are in different parts of the country and there really isn't a common repeater, okay, for them to use, or a point of common RF, I want to say, where HF doesn't necessarily work, but yet the group of four or five fellows need to make up, they're planning something, they're doing something, you know, they want to have a small conference about a project that they're working on. I wondered if that was possible on Echolink, as opposed to trying to pick a program somewhere out in the myriad sea of internet, and getting on, or getting on the internet somewhere with some other chat program of some sort. I had something very interesting the other night. My son Matt put a page up on Facebook for QSO. And, in about 4 or 5 days now, I guess it's been 5 days, there's like, and you got to understand, I'm Facebook stupid, okay? There's 1,700 friends up there, okay, which I don't know how all that works. All I know is they found us by means of the radio show, and because he's had me run promos on the air for it. So, I went up to look at it, and a gentleman in the chat room flagged me. And I'm trying to think. He was in Malaysia. And he said, do you have Echolink? And I said, yes, I do. He said, well, let's talk on Echolink. So I logged into Echolink, and we talked PC to PC on Echolink. And I thought, now that, I just thought, this is really cool. Of course, I don't go into chat rooms, and I don't use any voice chat on the internet, as I'm basically a ham. But I thought that was really cool. I could hardly understand what he was saying, and I'm sure he couldn't understand me very well. But we did communicate back and forth, and we talked about jobs and kids, and we did a little rag-chewing. And then when I got done talking to him and signed out, the thing that hit me was I thought, well, we actually did successfully rag-chew, where probably band conditions would not allow. And in some cases, in some cities that you go into, the rag chewing on a repeater is just, you might as well get on and use some foul language of some sort. They don't like rag chewing. So I thought, this is cool. This is an outlet to people who want to talk to somebody. And originally, I felt the spirit of ham radio was as if you could engage in a rag chew with somebody from a foreign country to talk about jobs and family and culture and things like that. You really learn so much about the other people. And it seems like that's an open door with Echolink. You can do that with Echolink, where you can't necessarily do it sometimes in the RF environment. Now, am I off base here?
Well, I think it raises a good point. One of the advantages you have when using Echolink over something else in front of your PC is the fact that you know it's a universe of hams. And we've already done the work for authenticating the users, getting them registered on the system, and getting them in a uniform directory format, namely by call sign. So you don't have crazy screen names, you don't know who this is, you're not sure if you can trust it. The idea is you can pretty much trust that all the call signs you see in the list on Echolink are authentic. So you have a pretty good idea of where to find somebody, and that if you see them on the list, it's going to be them. So that's probably one of the advantages, even if you're talking about PC-to-PC communication. But at the same time, I always try to remind people that this is not supposed to really be a substitute for amateur radio. It's supposed to be sort of like an accessory or extension to it, something that you use in conjunction with your usual amateur radio activities to make them more, to make them richer and more useful. And I'm trying to encourage people to keep the RF linking going, even if it just means setting up sort of a local, low-profile simplex link. In other words, converting your PC into a simplex node, which is relatively easy to do with a VHF transceiver, and just hitting it with an HT from within your neighborhood. Then you're still actively doing ham radio. You're taking advantage of the sort of portability aspect of it, yet you're still using Echolink in the same way that you did before. So I think there's a lot of benefit to that.
Well, I can see having a local link in your neighborhood being absolutely beyond a shadow of a doubt invaluable. Now, where I am now, and I'm in Lebanon, Tennessee, which is just outside of Nashville, our local repeater, I don't know what they did. They worked on it, and now I can't hit it with an HT. So where I'm at, I have nothing I can use an HT for other than, you know, simplex within a few blocks of the house. I can't hit anything with an HT. So in order for me to be able to take an HT and link it to a node or a local radio here in my area would be a milestone. I mean, it really would. I mean, it gives me a reason to own an HT. Otherwise, other than a paperweight, when I travel around, the thing's of no use. And those things are so convenient when you can walk around with a thing on your hip, or you can pick it up and talk. The portability of it is just, you know, it's fantastic. So I can understand that. Let me ask you this. Did you ever think when you started this that you would ever see an ad for a Kenwood radio on the back of QST that says Echolink ready? Did you ever think you'd ever see that?
No, I didn't. In fact, I have that. The first time that ad was published, I think, was about a year ago. And I have a framed copy of it that I cut out of the magazine and put up. And it's up with all my stuff here in the ham shack. And I think that's great. I did work with Kenwood on getting that working the way it does. And I know a number of people who have taken advantage of the feature in that radio. There's actually two radios in the Kenwood line that have built-in support for Echolink. So I was very pleased to see that. And you talk about the HT capability. Whenever I go to do a talk at a ham fest or a radio club meeting, which I do fairly often here in the Northeast, I always bring lots of props with me. And one of the things I bring is a laptop that has the software installed and a way to get an internet connection. And right then and there in front of the audience, I set up an Echolink simplex node. And they can see that it only takes about 2 minutes to put the pieces together once you've assembled them and get the node up and running. And the demonstration I always do is actually with an HT, just 50 feet away from the node. But the point is made that we are demonstrating amateur radio and not just demonstrating a computer.
Well, that's fantastic. And that makes it, like you said, all the more magic, you know, because it's incorporating that mysterious element of RF that we all have, you know, love so dearly, you know. And of course, I think the magic of that is what will attract, which will attract and can attract younger people into the hobby, as we keep talking about the fact we need young folks in the hobby. But I think that little added attraction is takes it head and shoulders over just computer chat rooms, you know, and all the other activities that take place, the blogging and whatnot on the internet, all the different internet activities where guys are logging into a room and they're talking and they have avatars and all the other things. The fact that you're traveling over RF, I think, is it really takes on a whole completely different dimension. And I had the 9-year-old gal I talked to, and I can't think of her name. She was really sweet. She's got her extra class license. And we were broadcasting live from Huntsville, and we were talking, and I said, well, what do we have to do in ham radio in order to attract more young people? And she stopped for a minute, and she came back, and she says, I don't think we got to do anything. She says, it's cool enough as it is. And I thought that was the precise answer I was looking for. And, man, she hit it right on the nail right on the head. Let me ask you about HF. I see a few HF receivers here and there. Once in a while, I'll run across an HF receiver on Echolink. How difficult is it to incorporate Echolink into an HF transceiver?
Well, the challenge with HF is not so much the fact that it's HF, but that it's single sideband, which doesn't have a detectable carrier, unless your rig isn't adjusted right. So the problem is that it's very difficult to detect when the connection needs to be switched over to the other direction. In other words, when transmit and receive begin and end, since it's kind of a vague thing on single sideband. And Echolink is designed on purpose to be half duplex. In other words, it's not capable of transmitting and receiving it at the same time. And the reason for that is that it is designed to work with FM transceivers that are inherently half duplex. A transceiver can only transmit or receive at once, and it's almost always used with transceivers, so it's very important to have an interlock to prevent people from doubling inadvertently. So before you can begin transmitting on Echolink, you have to have finished receiving, basically. The signal at the other end needs to have ceased. And this is a problem for SSB, of course, because the signal at the other end doesn't have a beginning or an end. So the most obvious solution is to go to full duplex mode. But the problem with full duplex mode is it's incompatible with VHF links. So if you had a situation where you had a full duplex node out there, it would really be incompatible with most of the other nodes on the system because the other station would never have a chance to break in. A couple of stations have set up SSB links on HF with some success, and they've worked around this problem either two ways. One of them is to sort of synthesize a receive signal busy by putting a timer on the SSB S meter and having a threshold, sort of like a squelch for single sideband. And the other is to have a system where you have to switch over by sending a text command, so that you would send a text command to begin transmitting, and that would tell the other side to cease transmitting. I don't know if I've explained that very well, but it's kind of a force fit because it really isn't designed for single sideband, but a few stations have done it.
Well, I guess I was thinking of it in terms of, and being that I don't know as much about this as I should, in terms of placing an HF rig on Echolink, and then would it not work with the, you know, push-to-talk sort of, where you log in and the rig is on and it's sending audio to you just like a VHF rig would be? You press the space bar, it throws that radio into transmit, and then you have your, basically what you're doing is via Echolink, you're remote controlling that radio. In other words, what you're saying is it doesn't work well in that mode. The reason why I'm asking is I was wondering about HF rigs or being able to place an HF rig on Echolink for the benefit of those folks that can't have an HF rig in their shack or
and maybe they can't even afford one. You know, maybe especially if it's a retired person or something and they're in an apartment. You're listening to QSO, and we'll be back with more of QSO, as well as Jonathan Taylor, the creator of Echolink K1RFD, right after this. If you already own a TW2010 Adventurer or Backpacker antenna, and you want to use the antenna on 40 meters, you can get the Transworld Adventurer 4040 Array Box in center section only, right now only $139.95. That puts you on 40 meters, and you're dealing with the exact same antenna structure that has made the TW2010 Transworld Adventurer so famous. The black powder coating, the stealth, the way the antenna is able to hide. And in addition to that, it's portable if you want to take it with you. Of course, you can get it with a deluxe travel bag. It's just fantastic. Go to the website and check it out, transworldantennas.com. That's transworldantennas.com. If you can't remember Transworld Antennas, just remember to go to our website at QSO, tedrandall.com, TEDRANDALL.com, and click on the link for Transworld Antennas. Take a look at this brand new Adventurer 4040.
If you're the decision maker for any form of outdoor lighting, you're going to want to listen to this. The Light Pack Systems induction lights, manufactured in the USA by a severely disabled workforce, uses a unique physical principle of light generation. This lamp system is therefore classified in a new family of sources, the Light Pack induction lamp systems. Light Pack induction lighting is a breakthrough for professional, general, and special lighting applications. Not only because of its high luminescence and efficiency, but especially because of its unprecedented lifetime. System lifetime is rated at 100,000 hours, or about 20 years, based on 5,000 burning hours per year, with a failure rate of less than 10%. With this unmatched durability, LightPack offers substantial savings in direct maintenance costs as well as indirect costs. Induction lighting is relatively new in the United States, but it's proven technology developed in Europe over 20 years ago. Therefore, claims of durability is based on real-world empirical data, as opposed to estimated design life provided by competitive lighting technologies such as LED. LightPack Systems was founded on the principles of green solutions for modern lighting through strong partnerships with the U.S. military, the University of Central Florida, and several national energy service companies. LightPack offers lighting solutions that provide a better quality of light with a 66% energy savings, also lasting up to 5 times longer than standard lighting options. LightPack's quality shines through with their standard 10-year warranty on all products. Call today for your free demonstration. Go to their website, lightpacksystems.com. That's lightpacksystems.com, spelled LitePackSystems, lightpacksystems.com.
Are you needing a place to put up a website? Have you looked around? Do you want to do something that's easy, that's simple, and very, very inexpensive, but yet looks professional? Are you having troubles with your computer? Do you need some tech support help? Are you tired of being connected to India every time you pick up the telephone to get some help on a machine or on a website? The people to call is tux-support.com. That's tux-support.com. T-U-X, like tuxedo, dash support, the word support, .com. These are the people to call. They can get you going. It won't cost you an arm and a leg. You can afford to work with these folks. They're professionals. They answer in plain English, and they can help you do things from a very, very basic, simple standpoint. If you have something that you want to do that's a complex project, well, they can handle that as well. But if you're like I am, when you're trying to put something up on the web or you need help with a computer, you really want somebody that speaks English. And you want it to be simple, and you don't want to have to pay an arm and a leg for it. And you want to deal with some good folks. Go to their website, tux-support.com. That's tux-support.com.
At QSO, we've got a new prize closet, and we've got some interesting things going into that prize closet. Be sure and write us and send us that email that says, I want to win. Put that in the text somewhere in that email and go to our website, QSOradioshow.com. That's QSOradioshow.com, and send us an email. Tell us a little bit about yourself, where you're listening, how the signal's coming in, or if you're listening by podcast, but be sure and put on that email, I want to win, because we're going to have some really, really neat things to give away. We'll be putting those things up on the website and telling you more about them on the air. Be sure and don't miss out. Send us an email and put in there, I want to win. Go to QSOradioshow.com. That's QSOradioshow.com or TedRandall.com, R-A-N-D-A-L-L. And we'll look for your email. And now, ladies and gentlemen, back to our guest on QSO, Jonathan Taylor, K1RFD, the creator of Echolink, being able to have access to an HF rig, in order to be able to tune in. I guess it would have to be a one person at a time access, but I've wondered about that. I wondered how complex it was. And I think what you're talking about, are you talking about the possibility of multiple users on one radio, or am I totally lost here?
Well, it's a somewhat complicated subject, but yes, part of it is multiple users on one radio, and the other, quite frankly, is the problem of somebody connecting through another node. So that because the HF rig is on the system, it means that it is normally available to PC users as well as mobile VHF users. And the biggest complication there is that mobile VHF users would never be able to take control of the transmit because it would constantly be sending to them. However, it's not a problem for a PC user, so there has been some success in putting HF rigs on Echolink that PC users can use one at a time. It's just that it's not really designed for that. Alternatively, there are a number of HF rigs available on the Internet using other software, which is much more adaptable to it and gives you not only the ability to, you know, hit the space bar to transmit, but also gives you full remote control capability. So you can change frequencies, you can see the S-meter moving up and down, you can change modes and bands and tune the antenna and do all that kind of stuff. And a lot of rigs now offer software, or software has been written for them, that lets you do that kind of thing over a remote connection, so that all you're missing there is the security aspect of it, the authentication, so that you can make sure that only licensed hams are operating your HF transceiver remotely. But there's a lot of potential for doing that.
Well, I wondered about it because I know there's several HF transceivers that are on just as receivers. And I always thought that was kind of cool. And you can, of course, this has been by logging in by means of PC. I've never tried to log into one of those things over, you know, through a repeater, through Echolink, and be on an HT or on a radio. And I'm not that far advanced with it, so I wouldn't know how to control that receiver by means of a radio. I'm sure there's probably touch tone commands or something that you can use. But I wondered about that because from PC users, you know, hams that are PC users that have their notebooks or whatnot, it just seems to me that would be a really good thing. I know I talk to a lot of fellows that are very, very, I would say, somewhat depressed and disappointed because they've had to move into areas where there's no antennas allowed, and they long for being able to get on an HF rig of some sort, you know. And I thought, well, if there were, you know, if there were two or three of these rigs available at all times and they were connected up to something where these guys could get on and use them, that might be really a real cool thing. And I wondered about it on Echolink. I'd never seen or had any experience with anything like that. So I asked the question. So what you're basically saying is this Echolink is not really designed for that. It's kind of takes it out of its league, although it can be adapted and used that way if a person wanted to do that.
Yeah, that's pretty much the summary of it, and some folks have done some good jobs of adapting Echolink for that. One of the things that I included in the software starting about 5 years ago was an application programming interface, an API, which is a way that programmers can make their own custom extensions to the software, so that you download the software and then you can look around on the internet for other sort of add-on tools for it, which are produced by other hams that are designed to be work in conjunction with EchoLink. And one such adaptation is something that makes it easier to connect the HF transceiver to the system. So that's an example of some distributed development through enterprising hams that are looking for a solution to something.
Well, let's talk for a minute about the structure as far as EchoLink is concerned. And I want to ask this question, and that is, how do you get support for this project? Because I know it can't. In other words, everything you do today costs money. I mean, I don't care what it is, somebody's got to write a check for something. And in all the stuff that you're doing, I can only just imagine that there's a horrendous amount of expense in keeping this up and doing what you do. And I want to ask that question because I think that if there's a means that hams can use to support what you're doing, I think that's something that they need to do. How does EchoLink get support, I guess I want to say?
Well, I was really insistent when this project started that it would always be free of charge, and it always has been. I think that's just kind of the spirit of things in ham radio. I am a professional software developer, but this is not my profession, writing ham radio software. So that is still the case. And as the system started to grow, it became clear that it wasn't the kind of thing I could keep running out of my basement any longer. So the central servers are at a professionally run 24/7 raised floor hosting facility with very fat pipes to the internet. And as you say, that does cost money. There is a pretty high monthly charge to operate these servers. Somebody came up with an idea, I can't remember who it was, about maybe 4 or 5 years ago, that said, why don't you offer, when you sign up for EchoLink, you get a node number, which is basically essentially a serial number. It's really a random sequence of digits almost. But somebody suggested, why don't you have a system of having vanity node numbers so that for a fee, you can request a specific node number. And the advantage of this is you can get a much shorter one than you otherwise would. Right now, if you were to sign up for EchoLink, you would get a 6-digit node number. But there are a number of 4-digit node numbers which have never been assigned. So I put up a web page that said, okay, if you want to contribute to the project, here's a way to do it. You can get a vanity node number. And for a fee, it'll be assigned to your call sign instead of the one that you started with. And I'm really amazed at how many people have taken me up on that offer. And I'm pleased to say that the income from just the vanity node number program completely covers the cost of operating the servers, the internet bandwidth, and occasionally the software licenses that we need to keep the system going.
Well, that is a good thing, and that's amazing. I would encourage folks to get a vanity node number then, because we want to see this thing continue and to grow, because it's part of the new amateur radio technology that's going to catapult this hobby into the future and provide a means for this hobby to continue going. Because if we don't grow technologically, the hobby will die. And EchoLink is just one of those things that puts adrenaline back into the system and provides, people with probes the imagination and prods the individual to look into different areas that maybe they haven't looked into, and to intrigue young people. I want to make sure that this project continues, and I wanted to find out about that because I could just imagine. You're talking bandwidth is expensive, especially if you're running servers outside of the home somewhere in a data center. None of that comes very cheap. Now, when a person gets onto EchoLink, they are now, how much of it is is point to point bandwidth? Like for example, if I'm on a PC and I log into a repeater, how much of that is dependent bandwidth wise on your servers? In other words, the audio and whatnot.
Well, the way it works is that the central servers that I'm operating are used really for directory services and for authentication. In other words, that's the thing that you log into when the EchoLink software starts. And it keeps track of everybody who's on the system and sort of connects the call sign to the IP address. But all of the voice traffic is peer-to-peer, so it does not go through the server, which is the only way to make the system scale. We'd have to have an enormous server farm if all of the audio had to go through central servers. So it is peer-to-peer or point-to-point, so that when you are connected to somebody, all of your audio traffic, the voice over IP protocol, is going directly from your computer over the internet to the other computer. This introduces some problems with respect to firewalls, but it makes the system much more scalable and really allows it to expand to just about any size that we could imagine. And there's plenty of additional capacity in the addressing servers, the validation servers, because they're designed to be scaled horizontally. So that's a place where there's plenty of room for growth, and that's simply because it's a distributed system.
You're listening to QSO, and we'll be back with more of QSO, as well as Jonathan Taylor, the creator of Echolink, K1RFD, right after this. How many of you would like to operate 80 meters, but you can't because of antenna restrictions? Well, that's over. You can operate 80 meters right now. You can operate from your home, your apartment. You can take it on the road with you. It's the brand new Transworld Antennas 8080. Go to their website and check it out, transworldantennas.com. This is a portable antenna, but it can be a permanent antenna. It's stealth. It's not a low-profile antenna. This thing is a performance-driven piece of engineering. You need to see it. It will be at Dayton, and you need to hear one of these on the air. If you want to operate 80 meters and you can't, I love the 80-meter band. I can't imagine not being able to operate on 80. But nonetheless, if you're in that position, don't stay in that position. Go to the website and check it out, transworldantennas.com. Go up there and take a look at their brand new 8080 and look forward to Dayton.
If you like to travel, if you're a camper, if you'd like to take your ham radio hobby with you when you go, you need the Transworld Antennas TW2010L Backpacker Antenna. It's the same exact antenna as the TW2010 Adventurer, with the exception it's been streamlined for the person who likes to camp and travel light. It's the same rugged antenna structure as the TW2010, with the black powder coating and stealth design. We all know the TW2010 is a great permanent or portable antenna, but the TW2010L Backpacker takes portable and emergency operation to an entirely new level. It's especially suited for the amateur operator who loves backpacking, cycling, camping. It makes easy access and quick setup possible for the most extenuating emergencies. TW2010L Backpacker Antenna is available now for a limited time for only $399.95. That's right, $399.95. Pricing includes backpacker, quadra stand, carrying bag, and free shipping in the continental United States through FedEx Ground. That's transworldantennas.com. And now for a limited time, only $399.95. That's transworldantennas.com.
Since the beginning of time and across the history of radio broadcasting, there's only one radio station that has ever earned a full-length documentary dedicated totally and completely to its rise to a pinnacle never before achieved by any radio station, and its fall. This is a story of what happened when the most legendary programming genius of all time takes the reins of an obscure Canadian radio station in the small city of Windsor, Canada, and creates a radio legend that rocked the Motor City, the USA, and half a continent.
Well, that does it for Big Tom Rivers, 1971, and Hank O'Neill. Starts a brand new year next at CKLW. For the last time this year, I will say to you, rock on, mother! Ladies and gentlemen, the beat goes on.
CKLW.
2020 news guys, they were disc jockeys without music. Bum, bum, bum. And everybody knew that something was going to happen. You knew something was going to happen.
Motor City Mayor Roman Gribbs has a mad on for an unidentified rapist, a butcher knife-wielding pervert cornered a secretary in the elevator at Detroit City County Building and rode her to the vacant seventh floor and proceeded to sexually assault her. Guards are now being considered for future surveillance of the crime-stained seventh floor. Lee Marshall, 2020 News.
Now, Markham Street Productions takes you there as you relive the rise and fall of
the big HCKLW, the Motor City.
You can now own your own copy of this new DVD documentary, Radio Revolution, the rise and fall of the Big 8 from Markham Street Productions. The special edition DVD of this award-winning feature-length documentary includes extra scenes, outtakes, photos, and special features. Radio Revolution, the rise and fall of the Big 8 is now available for only $29.95 plus shipping. Go to RadioRevolutionDVD.com. That's RadioRevolutionDVD.com. Order now while supply lasts. RadioRevolutionDVD.com. That's RadioRevolutionDVD.com.
And the hits just keep on coming.
CKLW. The Motor City.
Are you needing a place to put up a website? Have you looked around? Do you want to do something that's easy, that's simple, and very, very inexpensive, but yet looks professional? Are you having troubles with your computer? Do you need some tech support help? Are you tired of being connected to India every time you pick up the telephone to get some help on a machine or on a website? The people to call is tux-support.com. That's tux-support.com. T-U-X, like tuxedo, dash support, the word support, .com. These are the people to call. They can get you going. It won't cost you an arm and a leg. You can afford to work with these folks. They're professionals. They answer in plain English, and they can help you do things from a very, very basic, simple standpoint. If you have something that you want to do that's a complex project, well, they can handle that as well. But if you're like I am, when you're trying to put something up on the web or you need help with a computer, you really want somebody that speaks English. And you want it to be simple, and you don't want to have to pay an arm and a leg for it. And you want to deal with some good folks. Go to their website, tux-support.com. That's tux-support.com. At QSO, we've got a new prize closet, and we've got some interesting things going into that prize closet. Be sure and write us and send us that email that says, I want to win. Put that in the text somewhere in that email and go to our website, QSORadioShow.com. That's QSORadioShow.com, and send us an email. Tell us a little bit about yourself, where you're listening, how the signal's coming in, or if you're listening by podcast, but be sure and put on that email, I want to win, because we're going to have some really, really neat things to give away. We'll be putting those things up on the website and telling you more about them on the air. Be sure and don't miss out. Send us an email and put in there, I want to win. Go to QSORadioShow.com. That's QSORadioShow.com or TedRandall.com, RANDALL. And we'll look for your email. And now, ladies and gentlemen, back to our guest on QSO, Jonathan Taylor, K1RFD, the creator of Echolink.
You know, since you added the feature, there's a feature in there now that the proxy thing, I've noticed that even with a notebook, you can log in from just about anywhere. I mean, I've yet to see any place that I cannot bring up and use Echolink. Now, before, that was a problem because it seemed like, well, those ports, there was certain, there's two ports that had to be open at all times on every firewall and every router, and that really got to be quite a pain at times, you know, and because you'd have to try to get a hold of, I mean, I know where I was, even where I wanted to use Echolink from work, I had to get into the main firewall and open those ports and make sure that everything was passing through to my PC. And you've added this feature now, and I'm not sure how it works. All I know is it just works. If you use the proxy feature or whatever, the thing, you can just about log into it from anywhere. And how does that work, or how is that, and how does that function How has that changed at some?
Well, the problem, as you mentioned, is that when you're running EchoLink, your machine really is acting more like a server, which is an unusual thing for a PC to be functioning as. And the way, especially broadband internet service is set up, it's not really designed to be accepting connections to you from the internet. It's all designed for everything to be going out, because you usually are surfing the web or going to fetch email or whatever. And this is a very different kind of animal. And it requires that your PC be reachable from the outside world. And that's the reason that those two ports need to be opened on your firewall or your router. The way the proxy works is it basically takes that responsibility and puts it on another computer that's somewhere else in the world. And all you need to do from your PC is establish an outbound connection to that one machine, which is the proxy. And it is operating on your behalf, accepting connections and traffic from other users on the internet, and then just kind of tunneling them through that pipe that you opened up when you connected to the proxy. You mentioned that you can access it from just about anywhere, and that is now true, fortunately, even from places, shared internet places like hotel rooms or, coffee shops that have Wi-Fi access. I even got an email from somebody over the summer that said he was on, I believe it was a Delta Airlines flight, that offers now in-flight internet service, which works fairly well. He was using his laptop at his seat, and he was talking to somebody on EchoLink. So he wondered if that was the first time somebody had made a connection from a moving airplane to somebody on the EchoLink system. I told him I wasn't sure.
What a milestone that is. Yeah, you sometimes when you're on those flights, you wish you could operate an HT or you could... to kill the boredom, it would be so cool to be able to do that. Now, of course, on a private flight, guys can do that. But if you're on a commercial flight, if your notebook, if they had wireless on that airplane, that would just be that'd be amazing. I'd be able to sit there and talk to somebody somewhere. That would just be very, very cool. Well, I want to ask a couple more questions. I don't want to overstay my welcome here, but it's very rare. That someone gets to hear your voice and to talk to you. At least this is from what I understand. How did you get into ham radio? What was the thing? How early did you get into it, and what attracted you into the hobby?
Well, I was always interested in electronics, even as a young kid. I remember getting an electronics set when I was in second grade. And putting it together and bringing a working radio to school for show and tell. And I don't remember if it worked by the time I got it to school, but I thought that was kind of fun. And doing a lot of tinkering. It's a typical story for a ham, I guess. And then when I was in seventh grade, the school I was at had not one, but two teachers who were licensed ham radio operators. And they sort of got me interested in ham radio. So I got my license my novice license when I was 12 in 1974, and got on the air quite a bit, and upgraded in the years that came as a teenager, and continued operating. I was active in college at the college radio station, but then was sort of inactive for a while, and then came back to it about 15 years later. And I was very disappointed to see that my high-tech Yaesu FT-101 that I'd put in the closet, in 1985, was no longer the state-of-the-art rig when I took it back out again 15 years later.
Oh, man. It's hard to find the sweep tubes at one of those things. So it was basically academically, there was teachers in school that really sparked your interest in this thing.
Yeah, that's true. It was very unusual because I went to a small school, and we had not one but two hams on the faculty. So that was a big plus. I had sort of looked at ham radio when I was younger, and I was a shortwave listener actually before that. So I was sort of had kind of one foot into it already, and that just finally helped me take the plunge.
What kind of things did you listen to when you were listening to shortwave when you were younger? What sparked your interest there?
I used to like listening first to the low frequency bands, to the aviation weather reports that were they would be the ATIS announcements that were sent out over the the medium frequency and low frequency beacons. I used to listen to a little bit of ham radio traffic, but I remember the shortwave receiver I had, which was an old Hallicrafters portable. The BFO wasn't working, so all I heard was a lot of a lot of noise and a lot of sort of fuzzy dots and dashes without really a tone. But I used to listen to Radio Moscow and the BBC and all the major shortwave stations. Of course, Radio Moscow in those days was fascinating, hearing sort of the propaganda from the other side of the Iron Curtain. And I continue to do that even after I became a ham, since they used to plop themselves right down in the middle of the 40-meter novice band.
I know, that was always a pain. I always thought these international broadcast stations are just frequency hogs. They get right in the middle of the ham bands. I find it interesting now. One of the fun things to do is to listen to the news on Radio Havana. And at times it is absolutely hysterical because, it's so overdramatic and it's so off base. They're off in left field or right field or someplace. I don't know where they are. But, I sit and listen sometimes to Havana, Cuba's news, and, you're just rolling in the floor because they have this serious presentation and it goes beyond Saturday Night Live, that's really something. I recall, and I was curious, did you ever listen to any of the mailbag programs, like from HCJB or Trans World Radio or some of those? I'm trying to think of the one, and it's right on the tip of my tongue, big mailbag program that everybody loved. And it just escapes me right now. I should know it because I'd listened to millions of episodes of it. Did you ever listen to anything like that at all?
Yeah, I'm sure I did, where listeners write in and say all kinds of crazy stuff. It's also interesting that I was sort of on the other end of that, speaking of shortwave listening. I used to be in broadcasting, and I worked at a Clear Channel station. Actually, it was in Rochester, New York, and I was doing the news early in the morning when it was still dark. And I guess we had pretty good propagation because we would sometimes get SWL QSL cards from other places around the world. And there was one card that came in from Australia. And to prove the signal report, they had actually transcribed a couple of sentences of my newscast that day. And that was pretty cool to see that coming sort of from the other end.
Now, that was in Rochester, New York. Was that WHAS by any chance?
WHAM, yeah, which was had the unusual situation of being, 50,000 watts omnidirectional day and night.
I had the call sign wrong. Yeah, that station being 50 kilowatts really packed a signal all over the place. I remember tuning that in, and you could hear it anywhere. I was a Detroit native, but from Detroit and then traveling across the country, you could always tune in WHAM out of Rochester, and it would just come pouring in. So that was, you're listening to QSO, and we'll be back with more of QSO, as well as Jonathan Taylor, the creator of Echolink, K1RFD, right after this. In this day and time, what we don't have much of is time. And if you enjoy operating, and you just don't get a chance to, you need to take a look at the Trans World Antennas, TW2010, and all the models that operate the different bands. Go to YouTube and put in Trans World Antennas and see how simple this thing is to set up. It is easy. It goes together fast. And, of course, that gives you more time to operate. You're not fussing around with an antenna. In an emergency situation, it is absolutely necessary. You need to have one of these. If not for yourself, for your club, or whoever it is that may get called out on a scene where you've got to operate and you've got to be able to set up quickly and efficiently, go to their website, and that's transworldantennas.com. Transworldantennas.com. There's a link up there to YouTube, and you can see how quickly this antenna sets up, how easy it is to operate. Transworldantennas.com. You can transform any surface into a self-cleaning, antibacterial, antifungal, mold-free surface. Let it purify your surrounding air and protect your building interior and exterior from environmental contamination. any germs, oils, fumes, smells, or even little algae spores which land on a surface near tie docks will be remediated in minutes. Any exterior building surface we wish to keep clean needs to receive a little light and be coated with tie docks. Tie docks coating destroys viruses, bacteria, odor, harmful gases, allergens, air and water pollutants, and protects treated surfaces against the growth of algae, fungus, and mold. For more information on how you can use tie docks in your home or your place of business, contact Light Pack Systems. Go to their website, lightpacksystems.com, spelled LitePackSystems, lightpacksystems.com.
If you're the decision maker for any form of outdoor lighting, you're going to want to listen to this. The Light Pack Systems induction lights, manufactured in the USA by a severely disabled workforce, uses a unique physical principle of light generation. This lamp system is therefore classified in a new family of sources, the Light Pack induction lamp systems. Light Pack induction lighting is a breakthrough for professional, general, and special lighting applications. Not only because of its high luminescence and efficiency, but especially because of its unprecedented lifetime. System lifetime is rated at 100,000 hours, or about 20 years, based on 5,000 burning hours per year. With a failure rate of less than 10%. With this unmatched durability, LightPack offers substantial savings in direct maintenance costs as well as indirect costs. Induction lighting is relatively new in the United States, but it's proven technology developed in Europe over 20 years ago. Therefore, claims of durability is based on real-world empirical data, as opposed to estimated design life provided by competitive lighting technologies such as LED. LightPack Systems was founded on the principles of green solutions for modern lighting through strong partnerships with the U.S. military, the University of Central Florida, and several national energy service companies. LightPack offers lighting solutions that provide a better quality of light with a 66% energy savings, also lasting up to five times longer than standard lighting options. LightPack's quality shines through with their standard 10-year warranty on all products. Call today for your free demonstration. Go to their website, lightpacksystems.com. That's lightpacksystems.com, spelled LitePackSystems, lightpacksystems.com.
Are you needing a place to put up a website? Have you looked around? You want to do something that's easy, that's simple, and very, very inexpensive, but yet looks professional? Are you having troubles with your computer? Do you need some tech support help? Are you tired of being connected to India every time you pick up the telephone to get some help on a machine or on a website? The people to call is tux-support.com. That's tux-support.com. T-U-X, like tuxedo, dash support, the word support, .com. These are the people to call. They can get you going. It won't cost you an arm and a leg. You can afford to work with these folks. They're professionals. They answer in plain English, and they can help you do things from a very, very basic, simple standpoint. If you have something that you want to do that's a complex project, well, they can handle that as well. But if you're like I am, when you're trying to put something up on the web or you need help with a computer, you really want somebody that speaks English. And you want it to be simple, and you don't want to have to pay an arm and a leg for it. And you want to deal with some good folks. Go to their website, tux-support.com. That's tux-support.com.
Since the beginning of time and across the history of radio broadcasting, there's only one radio station that has ever earned a full-length documentary dedicated totally and completely to its rise to a pinnacle never before achieved by any radio station, and its fall. This is a story of what happened when the most legendary programming genius of all time takes the reins of an obscure Canadian radio station in the small city of Windsor, Canada, and creates a radio legend that rocked the Motor City, the USA,
and half a continent.
Well, that does it for Big Tom Rivers, 1971, and Hank O'Neill starts a brand new year next at CKLW. For the last time this year, I will say to you, rock on, mother!
Ladies and gentlemen, the beat goes on.
CKLW, the Motor City.
2020 news guys, they were disc jockeys without music. Bum, bum, bum. And everybody knew that something was going to happen. You knew something was going to happen. Motor City Mayor Roman Gribbs has a mad on for an unidentified rapist, a butcher knife-wielding pervert, cornered a secretary in the elevator at Detroit City County Building and rode her to the vacant seventh floor and proceeded to sexually assault her. Guards are now being considered for future surveillance of the crime-stained seventh floor. Lee Marshall, 2020 News.
Now, Markham Street Productions takes you there as you relive the rise and fall of
the Big Gate, CKLW, the Motor City.
You can now own your own copy of this new DVD documentary, Radio Revolution, the rise and fall of the Big Eight from Markham Street Productions. The special edition DVD of this award-winning feature-length documentary includes extra scenes, outtakes, photos, and special features. Radio Revolution, the rise and fall of the Big Eight, is now available for only $29.95 plus shipping. Go to RadioRevolutionDVD.com. That's RadioRevolutionDVD.com. Order now while supply lasts. RadioRevolutionDVD.com. That's RadioRevolutionDVD.com.
And the hits just keep on coming.
CKLW. The Motor City.
Here at QSO, we've got something new, and that's a prize closet. And we are in the process of filling that prize closet up. And we're going to be telling you on the air some of the items that we've got in the prize closet. If you'd like to win some of these things, we'd love to see you do that. But what you've got to do is send us an email. Go up to the website, TedRandall.com or QSORadioshow.com. And when you go to that website, just simply send us an email. Say hello, tell us where you're listening, how the signal's coming in. If you're listening by podcast, tell us how you have joined this radio show. And then put a little note in there that says, I want to win. And we'll put your name in the hat and we will have a drawing twice a month. And we're going to be giving away what's in our prize closet. Now, I can't tell you everything that's in there so far, but we'll be posting those items up on the website, and we'll be telling you about them on the air. But don't miss out. Send us an email and put in that email, I want to win. And let's see who the lucky winners will be.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, back to our guest on QSO, Jonathan Taylor, K1RFD, the creator of EchoLink, you know, and of course, a lot of the 50,000 watt stations, you know, CKLW in Detroit or Windsor, Ontario, WJR up in that neck of the woods. And of course, the New York stations. I don't know how many kids went to bed at night that lived out in rural America with a transistor radio under their pillow listening to, you know, WABC or WLS out of Chicago and listening to the, you know, the rock and roll music that you weren't supposed to listen to as a kid. All a part of that radio magic, but shortwave radio, because we had an old Gruno, and I used to park the Gruno by the bed and tune that thing in at night and hear all the same exact stations you're talking about, and I don't know, probably mid-60s somewhere. And at that time, there was a good proportion of hams that were operating on AM, so you could actually listen to hams without having a beat frequency oscillator. And it's interesting because I was talking to one of my sons that have general class licenses the other day, and I mentioned beat frequency oscillator, and their eyebrows went up, and they had no idea what I was even talking about. So there's where the rigs have become obsolete. We don't have BFOs anymore. I don't know. That's, you know, that no, on the little bitty radios, there's a single sideband switch, okay? But it's not a BFO. It's a sideband switch.
Well, for folks that are just, you know, they're thinking, they've thought about getting into messing around with EchoLink, how would you suggest somebody starts? Where's the beginning of this thing? They want to get on EchoLink. They want to learn more. Possibly they want to take a radio in their home and put a node in the home and connect this radio up. Where's the starting ground?
Well, probably the first place to start is at the EchoLink website, which is www.echolink.org. And as you mentioned, there's a fairly easy way to download the software as long as you're running a Windows PC from that site. And probably the best way to do it is just to install it and get validated and play around with it. As you said, there's nothing you can break, so there's nothing wrong with doing that. If you want to get a little more background on it, there are some resources on the website, such as a printable PDF manual, which is the same thing as the help files in the software. And there's also a book which is published by the ARRL, which is called VOIP, Internet Linking for Radio Amateurs, which covers not only EchoLink, but some of the other systems. We talked about IRLP at the beginning of the show, and a couple of other systems that are active for voice over IP, and that gives you some background. I can plug that book since I am the author, but it does give you a little bit of extra information that you might not get from the website if you're interested in reading something before jumping into it.
Let's review that title again so that folks know. You're the author of the book. The book is called...
The book is called VOIP, which stands for Voice Over IP, VOIP, Internet Linking for Radio Amateurs. And it's published by the American Radio Relay League, which is at ARRL.org.
Okay, so you're the author of that book, and I guess we could consider that to some degree the Bible on EchoLink as to how to make it work and what to do. Now, the software you download that you put on your PC... how does that differ, or is there any difference between it and, let's say, a person decides they want to link a VHF radio by means of EchoLink, and they just want to put the radio in their community? What else are they going to need? So now let's just assume, because most radios are not set up for EchoLink, obviously, like these beautiful Kenwoods are. What else do you need? Are there other boxes and gadgets you're going to have to hook up to make this thing work?
Well, the software is the same. It's just operating in two different modes. We call them sysop mode and single user mode. Single user mode is when you're using just your PC. And for that, the only thing you need are speakers and a microphone connected to the sound card and, of course, an internet connection. But if you're talking about setting up a simplex link, such as the sort of neighborhood one that I had talked about with you, the additional equipment you'll need is a VHF or UHF FM transceiver to take care of the RF part of it, and then also some kind of an interface device which sits between the PC and the radio. Now, the interface can be any of several different types. It will work with the sort of standard digital mode interfaces, such as the Rig Blaster, which is made by West Mountain Radio, or some EchoLink specific interfaces, which are made by other folks. There's a fellow whose call sign is WB2REM in New Jersey, who for years has been manufacturing a EchoLink interface, which connects to the serial port and sound card of the PC on the one side, and it connects to the microphone and the push-to-talk connection on the other side. There's also a fellow in Canada, VA3TO, who makes something very similar. So there's a lot of choices. And there's actually a list of these interface devices on one of the pages on the EchoLink website.
Well, the reason why I ask is I know that in talking with other hams, especially through the radio show, I hear guys make the statement of, well, I don't understand how to make that work. You know, I don't know how to, I'd like to do that, but I don't understand it. And I think the best way to do it is just like anything else in ham radio, you jump in. You know, you just jump in and do it. But now the new radios that we're talking about that are advertised, like, for example, in QST that says EchoLink Ready, how are they different? Do they have the interface built in, I take it?
Yeah, that's basically right. It's these two specific Kenwood models that have come out in the last couple of years. And the reason they are different is that they allow you to connect to the computer with just a simple cable. It doesn't require an interface device. Of course, it's a mini DIN connection on the back of the radio, so the easiest way to do it is still to get the cable that is manufactured by Kenwood in this case. And they offer actually two different cables. One of them is for the serial port connection, and the other is for the sound card connection. And you actually need the set of both cables in order to do it with those Kenwood rigs, such as the TMD710. But you're right. The difference there is that the interface is basically built into the radio instead of being an external box that you need.
Well, from a budget standpoint, if a person wants to do this, just ballpark, what do these interfaces normally sell for? What can they expect if they break the piggy bank to do this? What are they looking to spend approximately? Just ballpark figure. What is it going to cost them to take and put a typical VHF rig or VHF UHF rig onto Echolink?
Well, the most common solution, I think, is to use a rig blaster. And a lot of hams already have a rig blaster in their shack, so it's possible that the cost will be zero if they don't mind taking the rig blaster and putting it on a different radio. The other possibility is that you can actually build your own interface, which is a very simple circuit, just a transistor and a couple of resistors, which is what many hams have been doing as alternatives to rig blasters for many years already. But if you are going to buy an interface, typically it's about a $100 item, plus, you know, give or take the complexity. You can do it with the simplest kind of interface that's offered by these companies, which would cost a little bit less than that, but that's probably a ballpark figure.
So it's not really an expensive proposition to put a neighborhood node in your home. And, I, you know, I'll tell you, those are useful because a friend of mine was, where was he at? He was in Oak Park, Michigan or something like that. And he called me on the cell phone. He said, well, jump on Echolink. I'm going to be mobile or whatever. And he was in his neighborhood, and I logged into the node, and we talked for, 15 minutes or so. And he was out in the car. He had to run to the local Walmart, and he had to do all these little things. And that was kind of neat because we were talking over ham radio. Of course, there wasn't a local node that I could get on with an HT or something like that, but I was on my notebook, and that was very, very cool. Those things are just very neat to have set up. And I bet you there's a lot of people out there that would really love to do that that have never thought about it, but they never really understood exactly what all was involved. So the software you download for Echolink, other than the interface device, is all you really need. In other words, there's nothing.
That's true. Just a Windows PC that has a good connection to the Internet. I always recommend that it be a broadband connection, although it will work over a dial-up connection if you're in a pinch. And the right cables to go to your radio and the right interface device, and it really is relatively simple. As I said, when I do demonstrations on the road, I put it together in just a couple of minutes, so it's very simple to do. So I do encourage people to set up local simplex links and just try it out. Oh. And they have really the power of, you know, the whole system in their hand with an HT or something like that. In fact, you mentioned a situation where you're no longer able to get into your nearby repeater. This is one way you might be able to do that if the repeater is on Echolink. Even though you're not that far away from it, you can still make the connection through your system. And that's the way sometimes people have done this, just to extend the range of a local repeater. In fact, the system has always been designed for repeaters to be linked to each other and for multiple repeaters to be linked to each other. And the only requirement is that they be on the network. They don't need to have any other sort of prearranged frequencies or protocols. As long as the repeater link is on the system, it's capable of linking with any other around the world.
Now, is there any data transmission going on Echolink? I'm just curious. Are I know on 2 meters, there is some data going back and forth at times, and I'm just wondering: are there any machines that are data machines that people use Echolink for?
Echolink is primarily a voice mode. It doesn't have digital communication capabilities. It does have a very simple text. Sort of text chat feature, which can be used by PC users only, but it's primarily voice over IP. Some people have done CW over Echolink, but that's not a special mode. It's still just using tone-generated audio signals.
You know, I wondered about that because there's a big interest in data, but I suppose that would present an entirely new set of parameters that would be at this point an additional headache to try to pull off. But who knows what the future holds? And I guess now what does the future hold? Where do you see Echolink going? I mean I'm sure you have visions of sugar plums at times, and you think down the road of all the different kinds of things that could be done. What is it that crosses your mind at times?
Well, I think the biggest area for expansion is not so much a technical one, but an operational one. I think there's a lot of opportunity for clubs to get involved with using Echolink for public service and emergency communications, which is a whole other topic. So I think a lot of it has to do more with applications of the system than with technical innovations or enhancements to it. It's gotten to the point now where there's so many copies of the software kicking around that it becomes very difficult to change, which is sort of a bind that we've gotten ourselves into. It's difficult to introduce new features without making sure that they are backward compatible with all the existing nodes that have been up and running for a number of years. I'm always thinking about new opportunities for enhanced features, and some of those will be rolled out as time goes on. I don't see any major shifts in the way the system works. It'll continue to expand, but I think that finding new ways to apply it to our ham radio activities is probably the biggest area for expansion going forward.
Do you ever see, and maybe I'm asking a question of something that's already been done, Do you ever see a combination of machines that operate Echolink and IRLP at the same time?
Well, there's a very clever set of scripts for IRLP called Echo IRLP, which allows an IRLP node, which is running by definition on a Linux computer, it allows an IRLP node to be operated either in Echolink mode or IRLP mode alternately. It will be able to accept connections from either system, and it will be able to initiate connections to either system. It doesn't connect the two systems together. It's more like a dual mode thing that it does one or the other. But that's really the best in terms of flexibility, is to be able to have, with one set of hardware, to be able to support both systems.
Now that's interesting. Of course, I'm not as familiar with IRLP at this point, only because, like I said, I'm not within range of a machine that that will operate off of an HT, so that I can hit with an HT, I should say. So I'm more familiar with Echolink. I tend to do more on the notebook than I do if I'm out and about. And I did see an amateur at one point in time, and I'm trying to remember where he was at. He had a notebook installed in his vehicle, running at all times, and he was running Echolink, and he was doing access with his HT inside the building, with his car parked outside. And I don't exactly understand everything he was doing, but I do know that he was using Echolink, and he was accessing a repeater he normally couldn't hit by means of the HT through this portable node. Have you ever heard of anyone doing this? I mean, is there such thing as a mobile node?
Well, absolutely. As long as you are running a laptop computer and you have some kind of a mobile wireless connection, either through a system like you mentioned, the Verizon card, or even if you're in Wi-Fi range of an access point, you have some way of getting to the internet. It's certainly possible to do anything in that situation that you could do from a desktop, and that includes both local PC access using a microphone and speakers or a headset, or even an RF node that is set up to run portably or in a mobile environment. I sometimes do get questions also about versions of Echolink for smartphones, such as the iPhone, and I have been looking at that. There are certain technical and sort of regulatory hurdles to it, but I think there's going to be a lot of room for expansion into small devices like smartphones and netbooks, the tiny laptops, going forward.
That'll be interesting. Boy, if you could get... If you had Echolink operating on an iPhone That would be, once again, that would be another one of those visions of sugar plums looking ahead to the future. That would be really something. Well, you know, the idea, I mean, I guess in my head, I'm thinking a node is something that's permanent, but it doesn't necessarily have to be. A node can be it can be mobile, you know, it can be moving around or portable, because you say you go into these places and you set up something immediately, or you're operating a node, and that node doesn't have to be stationary in one place like a station, and then you can still use the RF capabilities. That's, you know, that boggles the mind. You think about it. We've come a long way since the Amico CW transmitters and Hallicrafters receivers. We've come down the road a piece, you know, since then. You're listening to QSO, and we'll be back with more of QSO, as well as Jonathan Taylor, the creator of Echolink K1RFD, right after this. If you already own a TW2010 Adventurer or Backpacker antenna, and you want to use the antenna on 40 meters, you can get the Transworld Adventurer 4040 Array Box in center section only, right now only $139.95. That puts you on 40 meters, and you're dealing with the exact same antenna structure that has made the TW2010 Transworld Adventurer so famous. The black powder coating, the stealth, the way the antenna is able to hide. And in addition to that, it's portable if you want to take it with you. Of course, you can get it with the deluxe travel bag. It's just fantastic. Go to the website and check it out, transworldantennas.com. That's transworldantennas.com. If you can't remember Transworld Antennas, just remember to go to our website at QSO, tedrandall.com, TEDRANDALL.com, and click on the link for Transworld Antennas. Take a look at this brand new Adventurer 4040.
If you're the decision maker for any form of outdoor lighting, you're going to want to listen to this. The Light Pack Systems induction lights, manufactured in the USA by a severely disabled workforce, uses a unique physical principle of light generation. This lamp system is therefore classified in a new family of sources, the Light Pack Induction Lamp Systems. Light Pack Induction Lighting is a breakthrough for professional, general, and special lighting applications. Not only because of its high luminescence and efficiency, but especially because of its unprecedented lifetime. System lifetime is rated at 100,000 hours, or about 20 years, based on 5,000 burning hours per year, with a failure rate of less than 10%. With this unmatched durability, LightPack offers substantial savings in direct maintenance costs as well as indirect costs. Induction lighting is relatively new in the United States, but it's proven technology developed in Europe over 20 years ago. Therefore, claims of durability is based on real-world empirical data, as opposed to estimated design life provided by competitive lighting technologies such as LED. LightPack Systems was founded on the principles of green solutions for modern lighting through strong partnerships with the U.S. military, the University of Central Florida, and several national energy service companies. LightPack offers lighting solutions that provide a better quality of light with a 66% energy savings, also lasting up to 5 times longer than standard lighting options. LightPack's quality shines through with their standard 10-year warranty on all products. Call today for your free demonstration. Go to their website, lightpacksystems.com. That's lightpacksystems.com, spelled LitePackSystems. lightpacksystems.com.
Since the beginning of time and across the history of radio broadcasting, there's only one radio station that has ever earned a full-length documentary dedicated totally and completely to its rise to a pinnacle never before achieved by any radio station, and its fall. This is a story of what happened when the most legendary programming genius of all time takes the reins of an obscure Canadian radio station in the small city of Windsor, Canada, and creates a radio legend that rocked the Motor City, the USA, and half a continent.
That does it for Big Tom Rivers, 1971. And Hank O'Neill starts a brand new year next at CKLW. For the last time this year, I will say to you, rock on, mother!
Ladies and gentlemen, the beat goes on.
CKLW, the motor city.
2020 news guys, they were disc jockeys without music. Bum, bum, bum. And everybody knew that something was going to happen. You knew something was going to happen.
Motor City Mayor Roman Gribbs has a mad on for an unidentified rapist, a butcher knife-wielding pervert cornered a secretary in the elevator at Detroit City County Building and rode her to a vacant seventh floor and proceeded to sexually assault her. Guards are now being considered for future surveillance of the crime-stained seventh floor. Lee Marshall, 2020 News.
Now, Markham Street Productions takes you there as you relive the rise and fall of
the Big Gate CKLW, the Motor City.
You can now own your own copy of this new DVD documentary, Radio Revolution, the Rise and Fall of the Big Eight from Markham Street Productions. The special edition DVD of this award-winning feature-length documentary includes extra scenes, outtakes, photos, and special features. Radio Revolution, the Rise and Fall of the Big Eight, is now available for only $29.95 plus shipping. Go to RadioRevolutionDVD.com. That's RadioRevolutionDVD.com. Order now while supply lasts. RadioRevolutionDVD.com. That's RadioRevolutionDVD.com.
And the hits just keep on coming.
CKLW. Motor City.
Are you needing a place to put up a website? Have you looked around? Do you want to do something that's easy, that's simple, and very, very inexpensive, but yet looks professional? Are you having troubles with your computer? Do you need some tech support help? Are you tired of being connected to India every time you pick up the telephone to get some help on a machine or on a website? The people to call is tux-support.com. That's tux-support.com. T-U-X, like tuxedo, dash support, the word support, .com. These are the people to call. They can get you going. It won't cost you an arm and a leg. You can afford to work with these folks. They're professionals. They answer in plain English, and they can help you do things from a very, very basic, simple standpoint. If you have something that you want to do that's a complex project, well, they can handle that as well. But if you're like I am, when you're trying to put something up on the web or you need help with a computer, you really want somebody that speaks English. And you want it to be simple, and you don't want to have to pay an arm and a leg for it. And you want to deal with some good folks. Go to their website, tux-support.com. That's tux-support.com. At QSO, we've got a new prize closet, and we've got some interesting things going into that prize closet. Be sure and write us and send us that email that says, I want to win. Put that in the text somewhere in that email and go to our website, QSOradioshow.com. That's QSOradioshow.com, and send us an email. Tell us a little bit about yourself, where you're listening, how the signal's coming in, or if you're listening by podcast. But be sure and put on that email, I want to win, because we're going to have some really, really neat things to give away. We'll be putting those things up on the website and telling you more about them on the air. Be sure and don't miss out. Send us an email and put in there, I want to win. Go to QSOradioshow.com. That's QSOradioshow.com or TedRandall.com, RANDALL. And we'll look for your email. And now, ladies and gentlemen, back to our guest on QSO, Jonathan Taylor, K1RFD, the creator of Echolink. Well, you know, I guess on behalf of the entire amateur radio community, I want to say thank you so much for putting the time and the effort and having the love for the hobby and the love for the development and the innovation and the perseverance and the dedication, because I can only imagine the amount of headaches that you've had, you know, bringing this service about and keeping it going. Hams, as a rule, are pretty good guys, but you can really have some you can have some real stinkers in the bunch. It give you a rough way to go. But you've really persevered and done well. Tell me a little bit about your team, though. You say you've got volunteers, people working and helping with you would have to have with a project this size. Tell me a little bit about those guys and their efforts.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up. I have just a couple of minutes, but there are two in particular that really have been keeping the system running. It's Bernie, W1CDM, who is in San Diego, California. And Terry, VK2JTP, who is in Sydney, Australia. And we have the benefit of volunteers working in now in three time zones around the world. And they've been with the system ever since the beginning. And those are the folks who are most likely to be helping people out with questions that they post on the website and with the ongoing process of call sign validation. As I mentioned, there are about 175,000 users on the system. And we still get about 100 requests every single day for new users. And all of them need to be validated. Sometimes that can be automated, but in most cases it requires somebody reviewing a license copy. And Bernie and Terry really keep that system going. So it's hard to believe that even after all these years, there's still that many new users coming on board. But we process more than 100 of those requests every single day now.
That's amazing. It really is. Well, hats off to you guys. You know, now where is the you talked about the main Echolink servers and all that. What city is that located in? When where are you at?
I am located in a little town in Connecticut called Ridgefield, which is northeast of New York City. And the primary hosting facility happens to be in Scottsdale, Arizona, at a colo facility there. Of course, it could be anywhere in the world, and you wouldn't notice the difference. I operate a backup server here in Connecticut, but primarily the other machines are operating in that facility in Arizona.
Well, that's all very interesting, and I don't want to take up any more of your time. I know you're a busy man, and I want to thank you for coming on board. And if there's any other comments, anything that you'd like to say to the general ham community between the shortwave broadcasting and the podcasting, we reach an awful lot of folks. If there's anything you'd like to say or anything you'd like to share, by all means, do it now.
Okay, Ted. Well, it's been a pleasure speaking with you. I think that the main message to go away from as far as systems like Echolink is that this is really a chance for interoperating with the existing ham radio systems that we have. I think that the amazing thing, if you think about it, is that our amateur radio service, which has been around for many decades, is now really the only one that can take advantage of both RF and Internet capabilities put together. This is something that we have in our toolbox that we really can take advantage of, and whether it's, you know, text messaging over systems like WinLink or voice over IP traffic with IRLP or Echolink, I think we have a tremendous capability to serve the public here that's been largely untapped, and I think there's a very bright future for it.
Well, I want to thank you so very much. I did have one last question that was handed me from a listener that knew that we were going to be doing this show with you, and they were just asking a question. And I'll summarize this real quick. This gentleman was saying that, you know, he logs into repeaters and listens for 10 or 15 minutes, throws his call sign out, hears nothing, waits a little while, then signs off that repeater and goes to another repeater until he finds a conversation. He was told by a member or somebody, I can't remember who this is here. Let's see. He was told by one of the repeater operators that if he continued to do that, he would be kicked off of the Echolink system. Now, something like that doesn't sound right to me, but am I missing something somewhere here?
Well, I don't know that. I certainly haven't heard about that. That sounds like normal operating procedure. I am hoping that with the CQ feature to be rolled out, we'd be able to find a QSO a lot easier, so he doesn't have to go through all that trouble each time.
Well, I wondered, because I thought if a person is looking for a QSO and they log into a repeater and there's nothing there, no activity, and they wait a little while, they don't just jump from machine to machine to machine, To me, that just seemed like that was what the system was for. So I can understand why his question would be. There is. I noticed that there is a lot of I guess I want to say rumor in regards to Echolink as to what you can and can't do and whatnot. People have a lot of strange ideas, and that was one of the reasons why I wanted to have you on, because I thought you would definitely be the man to talk to. So I think that answers that question, and you've been an excellent guest. I really appreciate it. You'll have to come back again, and maybe I'll have some questions from listeners and whatnot that we'll have that we can put before you, and you can talk a little bit about that. And in the meantime, we want to encourage folks to get those vanity nodes to help and make sure that Echolink remains supported. And thank you so much for your time and all your efforts in coming on with us.
Okay, Ted, thanks for inviting me on the show. It's been a pleasure, and we'll look forward to doing it again sometime.
That's going to do it for this edition of QSO. We want to thank our guest, Jonathan Taylor, the man that made and created and conceived the idea of Echolink, K1RFD. And thank you, Jonathan, for being on and joining us this week. Be sure and tune in. We're on Tuesdays and Thursdays on WBCQ, Sunday nights on WRMI. And we look forward to seeing you again right here on QSO.